Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources, January 24, 1989, 3 o'clock p.m., Hearing Room C, State Capitol.
Afternoon, the Senate Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. I'll come to order, please. I'd like to take a moment to review our agenda. I plan to follow the bills as we had them posted here for hearing on Senate Bill 166 relating to used oil, then Senate Bill 167 relating to underground storage tanks, then moving on to Senate Bill 39, and then Senate Bill 38. If folks haven't had a chance to sign up to testify but wish to do so, let our committee assistant know. If anyone's got a real problem with scheduling, let me know also. We should wrap up, I hope, by 5, but we'll make sure in any event everyone has a chance to testify wishes to do so. Any questions about the agenda or work plan today? Okay, if not, why don't we start then with the folks who are the proponents of Senate Bill 166, and I think we've got some of our friends from DEQ on 166.
Already we got an amendment. Oh, that's 39.
Another clean bill. No.
Not for 166.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name's Fred Hansen, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. With me is Peter Spendolo, who is in our recycling program and our solid waste, hazardous and solid waste division, but specifically has worked both last session and this session with the with the used oil issue and road dust suppression. I have written testimony and then be happy to be able to answer, of course, any questions. Senate Bill 166 would give the department the necessary legislative authority to regulate the practice of spreading used oil directly in the environment to control dust or suppress weeds. Environmental Protection Agency tests show that used oil is often mixed with or contains hazardous substances, such as chlorinated solvents, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, heavy metals, and occasionally PCBs. Spreading used oil directly in the environment could result in human exposure to these substances, as well as the potential for water contamination. The department intends to use the authority under Senate Bill 166, if enacted, to prohibit spreading of used oil in the environment unless the oil has been tested and found to meet strict criteria for levels of contaminants. In Oregon, most used oil is now burned for energy recovery rather than being used for dust control. In the past decade, all of the larger businesses that do road oiling in Oregon have discontinued using used oil due to the risks involved and the potential liability for cleanup costs. The department does regulate the burning of used oils, as authorized under Chapters 459 and 466. But before most used oil is burned in residential commercial boilers or furnaces, the oil must be tested for chlorinated compounds and heavy metals. However, if the oil is spread directly in the environment for the purpose of dust control, the department does not have clear legal authority to require that same type of oil testing. Senate Bill 166 is nearly identical, and I'll go back in the bill and tell you just what the differences are, to the final version of Senate Bill 1011, considered by the 1987 legislature. Late in the 1987 session, this committee heard testimony from the major used oil processors in Oregon on the inequities of present used oil rules and the potential risks involved. We were also facing, as we are still, the potential that EPA was going to list used oil as a hazardous substance and therefore, or hazardous waste, and therefore being substantially more regulated, something we don't think makes good sense, that something like this makes better sense. In spite of the lateness in the session, that bill, Senate Bill 1011, passed this committee, the full Senate, House Environment and Energy Committee with broad support. Senate Bill 1011, however, reached the Ways and Means Committee at the end of the seventh legislative session, but was not acted upon. I would like to hope to think it because of the lateness of the session. Most states surveyed by the department currently prohibit or strongly regulate road oiling with used oil. The reason these states control road oiling is not only the potential health hazard, but also the enormous financial liability for cleanup if the oil is later found to be contaminated. Contamination caused by a single road oiler in Times Beach, Missouri, has cost the state of Missouri and the Environmental Protection Agency through the Superfund program $36 million, with the cost potentially going higher. In this state, the cleanup of contaminated oil at a road oiler facility in White City cost more than $200,000. Luckily, this contamination was discovered before the oil was spread on roads, or the cleanup costs would have been much higher. The department's concern regards road oilers who collect used oil from numerous service stations and other businesses and then spreads that oil without first testing to see if the oil is contaminated with hazardous materials. There is much less concern about households, farmers, or other used oil generators who use their own oil on their own property for dust control, since these generators generally know what's in that used oil and whether there's a hazard to be connected with it. For this reason, Senate Bill 166, as proposed, contains an exemption that allows generators to use their own oil or on their own or adjacent property without requiring testing. Again, provision similar to what was amended by this committee last session. There are many good products on the market for dust control that do not carry the potential for large liability and environmental damage that used oil carries. The fact sheet attached to this testimony lists some of those products. In summary, the department believes that there is a strong need for state regulation of dust suppression and other similar uses of used oil. Clear legislative authority does not exist at this time, however, to adopt the needed regulations. Senate Bill 166 will provide us with that necessary legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but maybe I could just turn you briefly to the bill. And on Senate Bill 166, line 9, the word untested was added from in addition to what was in the bill in 1011 from last session, making it clear that it's the untested portion that we are wanting to be able to deal with. And secondly, Section 3 was rewritten not for change of substance but for clarity because of the writing from last time. Other than that, this bill is the same as 1011 from last session. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I have a couple questions. Just a matter of information, is used crankcase oil likely to have, or does it ever have hazardous material in it?
Mr. Chairman, used crankcase oil at that point will sometimes have heavy metals because of the use within an engine. Generally speaking, however, the other chlorinated solvents and so on are mixed with used oils rather than becoming a part of it through its normal operating procedure. Mm-hmm.
And you talked about on a burning that is tested. Now, what if it's tested and found positive, and then what do they do with it?
If it, in fact, contains hazardous materials sufficient to render it hazardous, and again, it depends on, there are obviously many different ways of testing for hazardous substances, mm-hmm. then it must be regulated as a hazardous waste and must, in fact, be manifested handled at a hazardous waste treatment facility such as the incinerators in Illinois, Texas, or in Alabama. Uh-huh.
Okay, and had one more. Why was it this bill sent to Ways and Means last time? I don't see anything in this that would require that, is there?
It's a very small...
There was there was contemplated to be a very small fiscal impact as a result of the regulation. From our standpoint this time, we believe that it can be accommodated within existing regulation of looking at other recyclable materials and so on, and would therefore not require any additional staff or any additional resources, but rather just to be able to get the regulatory authority when we're dealing with those issues.
All right. Thank you.
Fred, do we have any idea how much stuff we're talking about here in terms of quantity?
Peter, I think, is best one to respond.
Peter Spendelow with the Department of Environmental Quality. In this state, we get about 6 million gallons of oil that is collected by the commercial collectors for recycling. Of that 6 million gallons, probably less than 5% now goes to road oiling. Most of it, approximately 95%, gets burned for energy recovery, and there are 1 or 2% that get re-refined as a new lubricating oil and other sorts of uses. However, there could be substantially more oil that is going for road oiling, but just is not material that is picked up by a used oil collector and that we find out about. There are a few people who are out there collecting used oil who we are not aware of. So there's potentially it's more than 5%, but probably it's not substantially more than that. It's probably just a a very small portion of the total amount of used oil that's generated in the state presently used for road oiling.
Fred or Peter, tell me, when oil is put on the road, depending on its location, I guess, there may be other side effects from that practice. I mean, I don't know the current state of thinking in terms of what's good or what's not so good in terms of what we spread on roads, but it seems to me if we're concerned about pollution generally, putting a petroleum product out on a road may strike some folks as maybe not being the best thing to do. I don't
think the concern is so much putting the petroleum product out on the road. If you put it down in a proper way, if you spread it thinly so that it doesn't puddle, doesn't run off the road and get into water, oil is an organic material and it will biodegrade over a period of time. If you put it on too thickly, though, the oil itself is a problem. However, what we're concerned with here isn't so much the petroleum product, but the fact that it's a used oil that could have contaminants, and it's those contaminants that could be a problem. You know, people are exposed to that. When the car goes over the road, it will pick up some dust, even with the being oiled, and people will be breathing that dust in, and thus, if there are contaminants in the oil, they will be, you know, getting those into their body. And so, you know, that's been our greatest concern. It isn't so much the oil, it's the contaminants that could be present in used oil.
Okay. Now, the exception provision would say that, quote, a generator person who owns the oil and owns the property, is there any limit? Is that just, you know, mom and pop, or are we talking about mega corporation if it owns all the oil and all the property? Are there any limits on for that exception?
As the bill came out of the House Committee last session, it came out without any limits. Theoretically, Weyerhaeuser, you know, which is a large corporation, generates a lot of oil, could take their oil and use it on their own logging roads. And I don't know whether you might consider that to be a problem or not. The idea was that the generator should know if they're mixing hazardous waste, and a large corporation would not be irresponsible enough to take, try and mix hazardous waste in the oil they're going to spread on their own property, because then they're going to face their own liability. If it's discovered and they have to clean it up, that's going to be very expensive. Whereas a small service station that generates solvents and then has a used oil collector coming to pick it up might consider that a nice, easy way to get rid of it. It would be difficult to trace it back to that service station. So that is why the committee back then, the House committee, decided that any size generator could have this exemption, and you know, I can't really identify that it is going to create a problem having an exemption for large generators.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important also to note that on lines 19 and 20, it is not only the property owned or leased by the generator, but also immediately adjacent. And effectively, what was being addressed at that time is that on a number of gravel or dirt roads, that you might have, in fact, the point was being made that you had an owner of property who might oil the road in front of their own house and property and their neighbor's property. And it was attempting to be able to address that that issue rather than beyond.
Okay. Further questions for witnesses? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Check with our assistant here and see if we have any other witnesses.
One more, just very quickly, if I may.
My name
is Bill Briggs, and I'm the chairman of the committee. I am one of the three oil re-refining operations in Oregon. We cover Oregon and Washington. Speak to four basic points. One, there is a need. Most of the used oil that is in existence today does have heavy metals in it. The lead is falling as leaded gasoline is being eliminated. But there are others, arsenic, chromium, cadmium, and lead are very common in the product. The second thing is it is the largest liquid chemical stream that we have in our society today as far as wastes are concerned, so that it is prevalent everywhere we do any type of industrial or commercial activity. In addition, this bill should help recycling. There's a lot of product. Peter spoke to the fact that it was 6 million gallons. A great portion of the product above the 6 million gallons does not come to the recycler simply because it is disposed of in undesirable ways. So there is a great need to, from that perspective. The only point I would disagree with the DEQ's proposal is that I believe it should be on all oil, not even the exceptions for the homeowner or the small property owner. It can be very hazardous there in other ways, particularly where you have in the outlying countries where the water tables can be affected, and there are a lot of them concerned with well water in the smaller outlying areas. If there's any questions, I consider myself an expert in the used oil business, and I'd be most happy to answer anything you might have.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kearns.
What's your estimate of how much is over the $6 million? How high is up?
We know of three or four dust collectors in the state of Oregon that are still in business and operating. Our estimate would be there is probably somewhere about 200,000 gallons a year still being applied as dust oil to control dust oil.
What happens, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Go ahead, Senator Kearns.
You're probably not the best person to ask, but your suggestion is you want to extend that to the landowner who is suppressing dust on his or her own property?
Yes, I would suggest that is a needed change.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you
for
your time.
Any further questions for Mr. Briggs? Tell me again, where's your business located, Mr. Briggs, in Portland area?
Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
I have another plant in Klamath Falls.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else on Senate Bill 166? Okay. Members may want to consider whether or not they're willing to take action on this bill today, since I understand it's essentially the same bill that passed from the Senate last session, but you can kind of mull over that thought as we work down our agenda here. Senate Bill 167, relating to underground storage tanks. I think we're going to visit with our friends from DEQ again. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, again, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Fred Hansen, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. With me is someone who many of you know well, Rich Ryder, who's in manager of our department's underground storage tank program. Also, the drug labs and a series of other issues in the hazardous waste area are under Rich's expertise. Senate Bill 167 addresses three critical financial issues associated with the state's underground storage tank program. And again, I think maybe it's important just to a brief comment. Underground storage tanks, principally carrying or containing petroleum products, but going beyond that by far, has been the subject of federal law that basically addressed the requirements and financial assurance provisions that were necessary from the national perspective to be able to keep leaking underground storage tanks from causing major environmental problems. Cleanups of leaking underground storage tanks are something we're seeing across this state, other states having substantial greater problems. What's at issue then is how do we have both a regulatory program ensuring that the tanks operate well and efficiently, and also have a preventative program that provides education, technical assistance to underground tank owners so they can, in fact, both operate and upgrade their tanks in a way that not only complies with the law but saves them potential liability. That's what is at issue here, and it's the issue of funding. As I indicated, Senate Bill 167 addresses three critical financial issues. First is that it maintains the current $25 per tank fee, per year fee, to finance 7.5 FTE of 9 existing base budget positions rather than 6 that would be supported by a $20 per tank fee. If you recall last legislative session, the law provided that the Senate bill to be able to have a $25 per tank per year for the 87-89 biennium, but to have that drop to $20 on July 1st of 1989. Second, the bill allows the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a fee surcharge to finance local administration of the state's underground storage tank program. And third, if a state's underground storage tank insurance fund is established, it allows administrative costs to be paid for from the fund. I indicated that in November of 84, Congress did establish a national program for underground storage tank regulations, and that program has been supported with limited federal dollars beginning in federal fiscal year 1986. After extensive debate before the Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee and the Joint Ways and Means Committee, as I indicated, the 87th legislative session adopted enabling legislation for a state program. The budget was approved that included three positions on federal funds and nine positions on other funds, funds from this fee. No general funds were provided for the program. Positions were consciously phased in the governor's recommended budget to reflect the developing nature of the federal program. The $25 per tank fee was approved to provide the other fund revenue. The fee by law is to be lowered, as I indicated, $20 July 1st, 1989. In preparing the governor's recommended budget this session, it became apparent that a $20 fee would not support the previously authorized preventative program. Three base budget positions have been deleted, as well as significant cuts in special payments that were intended to be used to prepare educational materials for the regulated community. Two of the three positions to be deleted are field positions in Bend and Pendleton that were intended to provide technical assistance to Central and Eastern Oregon businesses. There are three major reasons for this shortfall of revenue. First is that for the 87-89 biennium, the legislature authorized nine phased-in positions. A $25 per tank fee supported these positions in the current biennium because they were phased in. However, with the fee dropping to $20, the governor's recommended budget reflects that only six of the previously authorized nine positions can be funded. Number two, as a result of the federal rules, some 3,500 tanks have been withdrawn from the program since they first registered in 1986. Most tanks that are registered have been permanently removed or otherwise decommissioned. Some are tanks that incorrectly registered in the beginning. That is, some examples of heating oil tanks that registered but were actually exempt, and as one found out more information about them, took them out. And third, that federal funds have remained essentially constant since federal fiscal year 1986, even though program costs have increased due to inflation. The governor's concurrence, we are requesting that a minimum base program be sustained by maintaining the current fee at $25 per tank. A second issue in this legislation relates to potential local administration state program. Senate Bill 115, the bill dealing with the underground storage tank program from the 87th session, allowed local jurisdictions, if they so chose, to be able to administer the program if they wanted to be able to, although they had to receive approval from the Environmental Quality Commission. And although we have not seen a high level of interest to date, we expect some local jurisdictions will want to build upon the minimum state program in order to better protect their local citizens from the risk associated with underground storage tanks. Additional expenses will be incurred to hire local staff by these local governments. Since a local program will build upon the minimum state program, we will not be able to divert state revenue to local programs. Therefore, authority is needed for the Environmental Quality Commission to be able to adopt rules to apply a surcharge where revenue is needed to implement an approved local program. Again, that would be to be able to have that surcharge flow to local government. The last Mr. issue
Chair,
relates...
May I ask questions? The surcharge, would that apply to all tanks statewide or to the ones in the area where the local program was?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kintai, only to the tanks within the jurisdiction that chose to be able to have the enhanced program. Again, trying to tie those who wanted to pay for a higher fee to those areas that were going to get the benefit. The last issue relates to the development and operation of a state insurance program or equivalent risk retention pool to help small businesses. While the decision to develop a state insurance program is still being studied, it is necessary that authority exists to pay for administration of the fund out of the revenue collected by the fund if one is created. And again, I'd like to stress, if one is created. We believe that preventative programs provide significant benefits. The programs I've outlined based on the $25 per tank fee does not have nearly enough preventative aspects as we would like. It principally represents the minimum regulatory aspects required by federal law. As a result, the governor's recommended budget contains a decision package to further expand the services of the preventative program. Decision package 115 contains four additional field positions, one public affairs position to be able to deal with the educational brochures, and a position for our laboratory. Each of these positions would expand our ability to provide technical assistance on how to prevent leaks, detect leaks early, or confirm releases so early cleanup could be arranged. Early detection, repair, and cleanup significantly reduce costs, including third-party damages from a leaking tank. Revenue for strengthening the preventative program will come from the proposed hazardous substance and groundwater protection fund. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I see you've got some financial information appended to your
yes.
statement as well, to which I direct members' attention. If I understand you correctly, and I'm kind of interpreting your remarks, basically this program is not self-sufficient, at least to meet the needs as you see it, because of the fee problem.
Mr. Chairman, maybe the best way to kind of characterize it in kind of very brief terms is there are two parts to any regulatory program that makes good sense. One is the actual regulation. That is the requirements for registration, certification, have people, in fact, upgraded as required by federal law, and so on. Second part is to be able to deal with the preventative side. The preventative side is to educate people about how to properly test their tanks, how to properly install, what they have to look for when they're hiring a contractor to be able to do work on their tanks, other things that they can do to be able to help identify where problems exist. At $20 per tank fee, we would be able to barely, and in fact not even really, make our minimum federal requirements just for the regulatory program. The $25 per tank fee continued allows us to be able to meet that minimum federal regulatory program, but just. What we're then saying is, and that's all this legislation deals with, the decision package that I highlighted, because I want to make sure you see the whole picture, it would come out of the groundwater or the Hazardous Substance and Groundwater Protection Fund would deal with that preventative side.
Tell me again how much that is that you hope to get from that source to fund this program.
What's the exact dollar amount?
I don't have the exact amount. It's about $360,000.
About $360,000. I'd be able to pull out of my budget, but I don't have it right before me.
John, do you have that right there?
On the Hazardous Substance Fund. But again, that's not included in this legislation, as I indicated. That's, but to be able to understand the whole picture of what we think has to be done to do a good program.
Okay, Senator Bradbury.
Well, I just want to make sure I understand it. So what this bill proposes is that the fee would stay at 25.
Yes.
And then the rest of the money necessary to fund the program you're proposing would come from the Hazardous Materials Fund.
Yes.
Okay. Tell me what we, you know, you're talking about some people out in the field on the preventative program. What do they do? What are we buying when we have these people out there?
I'll have Rich run through a couple of good examples.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Bradbury, Richard Ryder, manager of the Hazardous Materials Program for DEQ. Basically, what we see these people doing is we receive a number of calls, even today, asking us to help interpret the federal law, how people can come into compliance. Who can they see to have a test run on their tanks? How to interpret the test results? What does it mean to put in a spill prevention device? Where can I buy these? If we need people in our field offices to be able to field these questions or potentially to visit the site and to help people understand these rules. And that's what we see as part of our preventative program. Rather than merely going out to see if they're complying, to be able to go the extra step to help them understand in layman's terms what the rules really require. When the requirement is it effective today, or do they have 2 years to come into compliance? How do they do inventory control? How do they do the mathematics to see that what they buy and what they sell matches so that they aren't leaking any product out of their tank? A whole series of those kinds of activities, helping the people understand the new requirements. We're by and large dealing with a whole new group of people that haven't been regulated before. The service station industry, the rural grocery store that sells gasoline as an adjunct to selling groceries. And by and large, they haven't been regulated by environmental programs before. And so they just have a lot of questions as to what do I do? Can you help me comply?
Now, you say, how many were you proposing to do? How many FTE were you proposing? On this, I think it's you said a decision package field staff.
In terms of the decision package itself, four additional field positions, one public affairs position, and one in our laboratory, a total of six additional people.
And where do the field people get placed?
We would expect that one would be replacing the present hut in Pendleton, one in Bend.
Portland, Salem.
One Pendleton, one Bend?
Those are our two regional offices east of the mountains.
Oh, okay.
And they would be then attached to those regional offices. Same way in Salem in our regional offices.
And one final question, Mr. Chair. What's the position for in the laboratory?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bradbury, that would be to run analysis when we have a suspected release and we're trying to determine which tank may be the source of contamination, the ability to run samples and give people results.
Okay. Senator Bunn.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hansen, your fee surcharge, is there any limit on it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bunn, in terms of length of time or in terms
amount.
Of amount, the statute would establish it at $25, period. No ability to change that by us.
The
per tank, per year.
$25 would be the fee, but the fee surcharge.
Oh, pardon me, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bunn, I was thinking about the fee that we were charging you. In terms of local... advocated a higher fee than the department advocated?
Yeah. That note was made of that.
Yeah. Chairman, the points that I think that are made in terms of how the program is going to operate and some of those issues would welcome those suggestions, and I need to be able to study it to see whether that's statutorily changed or whether or not it really needs to be approached differently, and that is through rule or something. However, I do make the point again that we are proposing that those things that are preventative should in fact be funded from the Hazardous Substance and Groundwater Protection Fund, and that the regulatory portion is the only that portion which should come from the fee, and that that is how both we structured our budget and how it seems to me makes good sense. So I would disagree with that recommendation.
Okay, as far as the latter part of his comments, which suggested a little bit different approach as it related to the local option. Is that an area where you folks might be able to sit down and reach some agreement, get a chance to confer?
Mr. Chair, I only heard his comments rather than have a chance to study them, but my answer would be what I heard would certainly seem to be fruitful opportunities for working out details. Absolutely.
Okay. Was there anyone else who wished to testify on Senate Bill 167?
Thank you.
Senate Bill 167. Anybody else? Okay. If not, we'll move on to the next bill listed on our agenda, and I believe up for first time for hearing is Senate Bill 39. And we... shifting focus slightly from DEQ to the Department of Energy. Mr. Graney, are you prepared to proceed at this time?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michael Graney, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. Senate Bill 39 deals with how we collect fees for energy facilities that the Siting Council cites or the facilities that we regulate. And the bill really is fairly simple in approach and does three things. First, it requires that applicants for energy facility site certificates pay the actual costs of siting decisions for the review that's required by the Siting Council, Department of Energy, and other state agencies. Current law, in contrast, simply provides for the Siting Council and Department of Energy to recover costs, but not the other state agencies that assist us in those reviews. Secondly, the bill, with respect to energy facilities that have already been sited that we regulate, provides that the department and the Siting Council can recover all the costs of regulation of those facilities. In current law, there is a cap that is based upon the size of the facility that really has no relationship to the regulatory costs. In some cases, these costs substantially exceed that cap. In other cases, they're substantially less. When our costs exceed the cap, there's no recourse to that energy facility holder. When the costs are less than that cap, we refund the money to the holder. What we're proposing is that for regulation that we be able to recover actual costs for that facility and nothing more than that. The third part of the bill deals with Trojan emergency preparedness and would provide that the state and local government counties involved in emergency preparedness and response for the Trojan nuclear plant, again, be able to recover actual costs. That would cover the Department of Energy and also on the state level, the Health Division and the Emergency Management Division. On the local level, it would cover Columbia County. Current law has a, again, has a statutory cap that was, I think, just an estimate and over time has proved inadequate. To put the bill into context, let me just mention briefly our budget situation. Our budget is, that we're proposing this session, substantially lower than prior biennium, about 30% lower because of reduced federal and Bonneville Power Administration funds. That's translated into substantial staff reductions that we're undergoing. We're looking at an FTE reduction of from 20 to 25 positions, which is 20 to 25% of our staff. At the same time, we have not increased energy supplier assessment substantially since 1981, and our budget proposal again proposes keeping the assessment at existing levels, and we believe that's a commitment we've made over time and we intend to honor. At the same time, for energy facilities, the cost of siting and regulating those simply exceeds the statutory caps that are in the statute, both for us and other state agencies. And we're suggesting that those who benefit from receiving site certificates or who are the subject of regulation by the state agencies pay those full costs. The alternative situation that we're in is that other energy suppliers who have no energy facilities would be the likely subject for making up those costs. And with our federal and other budget reductions, that's a luxury we really can't afford anymore. There is a detailed section-by-section analysis because the bill dealing with our siting statute and our fee statute is fairly complicated. I'd be happy to walk you through that or respond to any questions.
Okay. Any questions from Mr. Graney? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next up is Gary Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary Bauer with representing Portland General Electric. As one of the primary funding sources of the Oregon Department of Energy's activities, we have a few amendments we'd like to present, and it's my understanding that the committee staff has made those available to you. To give you some quick background, PGE payments this biennium are $464,413 under the energy supplier assessment, $565,000 for the Trojan site certificate, $147,000 for the Boardman site certificate, and $300,000 for Trojan emergency preparedness. In addition, during 1988, we paid $55,000 to strengthen emergency preparedness work with the counties and funded the work of a consulting firm to assist the Department of Energy with their emergency planning. If you Mr. Chair, do you want me to go through the amendments?
Yeah, I think we've got those. Let's double check here. We've got a copy of your testimony, and the amendments are should be found in the bill packets for four members and hand engrossed. Okay, yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that if you like.
The first real amendment, which on the proposed amendment, it's actually line two of that, simply clarifies that emergency preparedness activities of state and counties are to be associated with a nuclear fuel thermal power plant in order to receive the funding. I guess to be blunt, the state is having some discussions with the Federal Emergency Management Agency regarding some other activities, and we don't want to see ourselves become the general funding source for emergency planning throughout the state for non-nuclear, or at least non-nuclear plant-related activities. The second amendment would require that the costs for emergency preparedness be substantiated and the records made available to the operator of the plant upon request. The third amendment gives the director the flexibility to establish a payment schedule. Currently, the payments would be once a year, and we foresee some substantial increases in some of our fees. And in discussions with the Department of Energy, they've agreed that it would be possible to work out a schedule, moving that throughout the year. The fourth amendment clarifies that payments under the schedule are not to be considered past due. Again, it's a ties in with the above amendment. And that's our amendments at this time, and we appreciate your taking the opportunity to consider those.
Okay. Any questions from Mr. Bauer on his testimony, the proposed amendments? Not? Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got, Mr. Graney, have you had a chance to get a copy of these amendments yet?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We got a couple other witnesses. We'll call you, Mr. Graney, to comment after we've heard from those witnesses, in case there are any other areas to which you may wish to address remarks. Lloyd Marbette.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and members of the audience, my name is Lloyd K. Marbette, and I represent the Four Laws on Board Foundation. I appear before you today in support of Senate Bill 39 with the following proposed revisions. In Section 3, the Oregon Department of Energy proposes to amend ORS 469.360 by providing that an applicant for a site certificate, and this is on page 2, lines 7 through 11, shall pay all expenses incurred by the council and department related to the review and decision of the council. These expenses may include but need not be limited to legal expenses, expenses incurred in evaluating the application, issuing a final order or site certificate, and legal and other expenses incurred to defend the council's decision against appeals and legal challenges. While we support the applicant's responsibility for covering the costs of the council's and the department's evaluation of an application, and I would add to this that we would support the legal expense in conducting that review, and issuance of a final order or site certificate, we are troubled by the requirement that an applicant must automatically pay the legal and other expenses incurred to defend the council's decision against appeals and legal challenges. Suppose a court finds the council's decision was an error based, for example, upon legal argument contained in the appeal of an applicant or an intervener. Is it right that an applicant should be forced to bear the legal costs of a council decision which is not supported by the law? Is not the award of legal costs properly left to the determination of the courts? If so, this language should be struck, or as an alternative, the following language might be added. And I would just point out that we would add the language, if the decision of the council is substantially upheld by the court. In Section 4, the Oregon Department of Energy proposes to amend ORS 469.421 by adding subsection 6, and that's on page 4, line 40 of the SB 39, which would require each operator of a nuclear-fueled thermal power plant to pay the full cost of emergency preparedness. We believe this is a proper allocation of these costs and propose the following revision in order to make this proposed amendment compatible with ORS 469.533 which is added, and this simply puts in the words "and nuclear installation," which is a broader definition and one that is already contained in the statutes as it applies to emergency planning. I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today and provide this testimony. This is one of those rare occasions in which I support something that the Oregon Department of Energy is doing.
I'll make a note of that. With a couple of little amendments. Okay, appreciate that. Any questions for Mr. Marbet? Senator Bunn.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Marbet, would the addition of "and nuclear installation" increase the coverage under this proposal?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bunn, increase the coverage from the standpoint of the area of emergency planning, or
from the cost, spreading the fees and costs so that it would not just be Trojan that was covered, but other facilities in Oregon?
There are really no other facilities that would be covered, but the reason why I bring this point up is because the statute contemplates that there could be other facilities that would be covered in the event that such facilities were built and operated in Oregon, then they would clearly fall under that allocation of costs. But at this present time, we don't have that.
Okay. There are no research facilities or anything that would be considered a nuclear installation?
Research facilities are not defined as nuclear installations under the law. You'd have to look at ORS 469.300, and I'm not certain what subsection it is that defines it, but it's one of those.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Lloyd. Anyone else on Senate Bill 39? We did have Jeff McFarland. Is he here? Was here. If he comes back in, we'll let him have a chance. Anyone else on Senate Bill 39? Hey, Mr. Graney, you've had a couple sets of amendments kind of tossed at you. Can you respond at this point, or do you have any comments you'd like to share with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. First, with respect to the PGE amendments, we would have no objection to those. Those are ones we've discussed with PGE, and we would support those amendments. Secondly, with respect to Mr. Marbet's amendments, with respect to the first issue, the legal challenges, I think that's a policy issue for this committee to decide. Let me just mention that the situation we have been in the past is that legal expenses have been a major part of agency review costs. In the case of Wachang, the Wachang review, in which everybody appealed, there was about $25,000 of unreimbursed costs. In the Salt Caves case, which is pending right now before both the Siting Council and Water Resources Department jointly, Attorney General's costs have been approximately $75,000 to date. And that's not only for our agency, but that's other agencies involved as well. I guess if the council or if the committee felt that it wanted to limit situations where we could recover costs, I'm not sure it's a black and white situation when the council's decision is substantially upheld. For example, the Salt Cave situation right now may eventually end up with the possibility of a withdrawal of the application or challenges in federal court regarding federal preemption that may take years to resolve. And I'm not sure how workable that would be. I guess I would prefer to see the language that we had drafted as it is. With respect to the second amendment or the second issue, the nuclear installation, I don't have any problem with adding those words. I think I'm a little confused as to by where Mr. Marbet wants to codify that, and maybe that's really a decision for legislative council, because if I read the rest of paragraph, it appears to be identical. He's put it in a different section of the law, and I don't know as we have any concern about that. He did drop one sentence, and maybe that wasn't intentional, the last sentence about monies appropriated in his Department of Energy account. We would want to continue to have that language.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Graney?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mike. Anyone else on Senate Bill 39? Okay. Next, we've got Senate Bill 38. Mr. Graney, this is yours also.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 38, and this is a bill that you did have a hearing on previously. There's written testimony being handed out, which I will not repeat. Let me just briefly recap what the bill does, because we did discuss it some last week. The primary thing it does is this deals with the transportation of radioactive materials to the state. It allows us to delegate the permitting authority to the PUC for issuing those permits. Under the proposal, we would continue to develop standards, but we'd have the ability to delegate permitting authority. That has a couple of advantages. One, it simplifies things for the shipping industry because they deal with the PUC on permits for other materials. PUC has the staff and capabilities to issue those permits. PUC also does the truck inspections for us, and we're very comfortable with having them issue the permits. Secondly, it gives us some protection as a state from preemption by the federal government on our state permitting. In general, the federal government is very suspicious of states that permit and regulate nuclear shipments through their state when that's done separately from other materials. And by centralizing it, it appears that as a matter of policy, the federal government does not challenge the state as much. Second, the bill clarifies the roles of the state agencies, principally us and Health Division, in emergency preparedness and response. And what it does is it codifies what we have been doing for the last few years. In particular, Section 7 makes clear our responsibility and that of Health Division. And this was the issue that I had, when the bill was first heard, that I said we needed to get back to you on. The amendments reflect both our agreement and that of Health Division. In addition, the bill also clarifies our ability to enforce standards for transportation and disposal of radioactive material regarding first shipments unrelated to the Trojan nuclear plant, because current authority on that is unclear. And secondly, on our ability to go to court to enforce our orders. Our lawyers tell us that the current statute, while it was intended to give us that ability, is, from a technical legal point of view, is unclear. It's questionable whether we could currently bring actions in court. Finally, it makes a number of minor changes in terms of wording to make our statute consistent with federal law as current state statutory policy recommends. In making those changes, it's primarily wording and vocabulary changes and changing some shalls to mays. There's really nothing in terms of policy or how we would implement our program that's being changed. Let me also add that the PUC had requested us to clarify that their enforcement authority would be using their statute, and one of the amendments does that in Section 4, and we're comfortable with that approach. And it's my understanding both PUC and Health Division do support the bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Let's take some questions first. Senator Bradbury.
I just need to understand when you're talking about establishing consistency between Oregon statutes and federal statutes, are we making any substantive changes in the protection of the public in Oregon by making them consistent?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bradbury, no. And let me just give you an example. Section 1 of the Act, which we're proposing to delete in its entirety, one and two, are basically an elaboration of nuclear materials that was in federal law when this bill was originally adopted. The the ability to issue rules covering the same types of nuclear materials is reinstated in Section 4. The phrase by rule in line 30 in Section 4 is posing a significant hazard to public health and safety or the environment if improperly transported. It means essentially the same thing. There are also a couple of other places where there are sort of new terms of art regarding how they describe nuclear materials further on page 4 in Section 8. The phrase highway route controlled shipment prior to or upon entry, that highway route controlled shipment is a new term of art the federal government used. It basically talks about any high level or significant concentrations of transuranic waste. These are the ones that we do issue permits for that are placarded and have to they have to give us advance notice on. So our intent here is not to change the level of preparedness or level of protection for the public.
Okay. Further questions, Mr. Graney? Okay. If not, thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And let's see. Do we have anybody from PUC here today? Okay. Why don't we ask you to come forward and identify yourself, if you would, for the record. And Mr. Graney's assured us that this is fine with you folks, but we'd kind of like to make sure you've had a chance to be heard as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Harry Eubanks. I'm the supervisor of the research and analysis section of the Transportation Safety Division within PUC. The permitting function will be taken over by my employees. It is a function that we are presently doing with regard to certain other kinds of non-radioactive hazardous waste materials. And this function will fit right in with what we are presently doing. In fact, we are cooperation with the Department of Energy doing the safety screening on the applicants for their permits now. So it'll just mean slightly more work for us. But okay. We're completely in favor of this change.
Great. Thank you very much. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, any fiscal? What's the fiscal on this? I mean, are there fees collected by the Department of Energy which would now be collected by you, or is it just your, I mean, what's the fiscal impact?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bradbury, the fees would be continued to be collected by the Department of Energy. This would be a function that would be absorbed within PUC.
Explain that one to me. Why does the Department of Energy continue to collect the fees on radioactive material transport if they're not involved in it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bradbury, if I could respond, the department would continue to receive the fees and use those for the work that's needed on emergency training and emergency response with local governments along the shipping routes. And the PUC has graciously agreed to take on this function at essentially no cost. Because the number of shipments of nuclear materials compared to other hazardous materials is a relatively small number.
So, Mr. Chair, it would be used for what, local response training?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Is that a program you're currently involved with?
Yes, sir.
And you just
continue to do that.
Okay, any further questions? If not, thank you very much. You beg, appreciate your presence. Health Division. Let's hear from you folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Art Kyle from the Health Division. We appreciate the committee's patience and understanding from the testimony of last time. Our staff has worked with the Department of Energy, and the amendments proposed are in agreement with the Health Division. We totally support the new language and proposals by the Department of Energy.
Okay. Just a quick question for you, Art, or Mike, whoever wants to respond.
I guess I had a visit yesterday with a fire marshal, and I guess they're kind of the lead agency on hazardous materials. Are they in the loop here on radioactive hazards as well?
Yes, they are, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Has this been, I presume this has all been discussed, and maybe it's a result of the Interagency Hazard Communication Council? I mean, has it been discussed there, this whole shifting of responsibility?
You want to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bradbury, this specific issue has been, but not in a lot of detail. The people who are involved in responding in the event of an accident, in fact, are largely many of the same people. The IHCC also, of course, is looking at much broader issues. But that has been a useful vehicle for helping us to coordinate and develop our emergency response plan.
Okay, further questions? If not, thanks, Art.
Thank you.
Mr. Donica, did you wish to comment?
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, Tom Donica for Associated Oregon Industries. We support Senate Bill 38 as legislation which places the primary responsibility in the appropriate agency while retaining the specific expertise of the Department of Energy to assist the lead agency where that expertise is required. We do have one concern, and that is that in the spill response fund packaging contained in House Bill 2176, it is proposed that approximately $350,000 be funded by a fee on a tax on hazardous materials and non-motor fuel petroleum products. While the sum is not large, it complicates the funding of other programs involving hazardous materials and for which entirely new funding must be found, not unlike the argument I made on the earlier bill. We would urge that in this legislation that the PUC be authorized to collect fees from transporters of radioactive materials to fund this activity, with the further authorization that most of this fee be used to purchase and keep in place the expertise of the DOE, which the PUC will need on a continuing basis. In the future, we believe this will provide the flexibility to increase the number of trips, as the number of trips increase through Oregon, if they ever move the material from Hanford, and which the proposed method of funding under House Bill 2176 will probably not be able to do. It is also questionable in our mind whether the proposed fee or tax bears any relationship to the issues covered by Senate Bill 38. We appreciate this opportunity to comment. I would make this further comment, however, as I would understand the situation.